Welcome to the Weekly Juice Podcast, where we discuss all things real estate, personal finance, investing, and entrepreneurship. Whether this is your first time here or you're an avid listener, we're thrilled to have you as a part of our community. Our goal is to share stories of successful entrepreneurs and investors in the hopes that they assist you along your journey towards financial freedom. We discuss successes, failures, systems, motivations, experiences, tips and tricks, and key lessons learned over time. After each episode, you should feel motivated, empowered, and prepared to take action in your own life. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday to get your weekly juice. You can also find us on Instagram at Weekly Juice Pod, where we post daily content, personal finance tips, and document our own journey towards financial freedom.
Welcome back to the Weekly Juice. As always, it's your boys, Ryan and Corey, here with another episode for you. Today, we had on special guests, Anam and Amir. They are a husband and wife real estate investing team from Texas with over 40 doors. They specialize in the BRRRR method for acquiring their properties. And they also have a really cool acronym they use to find deals and kind of source the area. It's actually called AREA, so A-R-E-A. And they'll go through it in the episode, but it's a really good way to see if an area is a good fit for a deal.
Yeah, they broke it down kind of how they buy deals in their specific market. They self-manage those 40 units. They both work full-time 9-to-5 jobs. The excuses are off the table in this episode, what these people are doing. And they're a husband and wife kind of power couple team where they're partnered and they each split up their tasks. They've bought all of their properties within the last 5 years. So they've scaled it very quickly. And, you know, we're doing some math in the episode. They're definitely bringing in tens of thousands of dollars in cash flow per month. So to be able to do that, they are putting in the work and the time. They really, really know their market. They're buying properties sight unseen. Like, that's just how they're doing it.
Their first deal they found on the BiggerPockets forum and they bought it sight unseen. And it's just, it's cool. They take away the stigma of like, the fear, I guess you will, of like buying deals and going in. Is there like, when you know your stuff and you run it with the numbers and no emotion, you'll be fine. And that's how you should run your business. So really great episode and super motivating for people looking to get started.
Yeah. This is a kind of a living proof episode of you put in the work and then you reap the benefits of that work and you get so good and so confident at it that it becomes second nature to you, which allows you to be ahead of the game versus some of the other competition. So they really know their market and their goal is to get to 100 million in assets under management by the time they're 40. So I think 10 or 11 years. And I mean, after talking to them, how they're going to do it. So
100%. Let's bring them in and let them tell their story.
Cool.
All right. Well, Anam and Amir, thank you so much for joining the show. We are thrilled to have you on and we're excited for an awesome interview today.
No, we're excited to be here for sure.
Cool. So if you could just give us a little background on yourselves, who you are, where you're from, and then how you guys became real estate investors.
Background is grew up in Dallas, Texas, actually born and raised, haven't ventured out further than this wonderful metroplex I grew up in. And then went to school, SMU. I got my degree in marketing and advertising. I currently still do work full time as a marketing director. I haven't transitioned full time into real estate investing yet. I like the certainty of a W-2 income. Can't really let that part go, but I think the marketing side and the management side of what I do on my day-to-day helps our real estate side. And then the creativity that comes from my day job helps our real estate side of it.
Cool. So give us a little background on like the deep dive into real estate investing. I believe you both came from families that were, you were in the service business for a while, right? And then was it due to COVID where you guys started in real estate, or how'd you get into it specifically?
So both of us grew up like in family businesses, like ever since like we were young, like it's just how it is. You kind of just work yourself into it. You don't get paid. It's just like something you just do. You just work and help your parents out. As we grew up, like we started dating actually when we were like young too. So that kind of helped. I mean, we started dating when she was 13, I was 14.
Oh, wow.
So we kind of grew up together as well. And so, started like making some goals like early on that like, you know, we can't always be just helping our parents out and like doing their thing. We kind of have to do like pivot to do our own thing. So we were kind of always just sitting there picking at things like, you know, whether we wanted to start like a bar, or if we wanted to do this, or if we want to do that, or whatever the case may be. And then we would make a list, narrow it down, and be like, okay, we do want to do this, we don't want to do that. And like, I think one of the biggest things was like, we wanted to do a certain amount of work, but also have like flexibility throughout the day. So it's like, we couldn't, we knew that like service business is definitely not the way to go, especially like we growing up, we knew that like 15, 17 hour days is pretty normal in a service business. So we knew it wasn't going to be that. How we came down to real estate was like, and real estate rental specifically was that like, we would do the work, you would do a massive amount of the work in the front end, and then it's kind of coasting after that. Not necessarily coasting, but like a little bit, it's just a little bit less work after that. Cause once your rentals are rehabbed and tenanted, then, it's not, you're just managing them per se, and just, you know, collecting rent, handling the maintenance and that. So that's how we came across and picking real estate as our go-to.
Got it. Yeah. And you're correct there with saying that, like, if you front load all the work in real estate, it's definitely not passive. We've learned that, kind of the hard way, but also we were talking to some property managers today, cause we're going to shift our portfolio. And it's like, we were talking, it's a lot more passive than doing your W-2 job. And if you front load all the work and create the systems, then that level of passivity is never going to be 100, but you can be in the 80s and 90s with it. So it's, I totally agree there. What does your current portfolio look like right now? And then maybe we can work our way back to see, you know, exactly how you guys got there.
I think we're just shy of 40 units right now, and that encompasses single families and duplexes.
Love it. So 40 units. And then when did you buy your first? I want to kind of do a timeline of how long it took you to get to this just shy of 40 number.
Yeah, I think
early
to mid 2017 is when we actually got started. That was like our first purchase.
Love it. Okay. Yeah. So that's perfect segue right there. Like, how did you scale? Like, I'm sure there's a million different things that you could say, but what was some of the ways that after you bought, you know, maybe your first property that you were able to say in 4 to 5 years, maybe you didn't know you're going to have 40, but you do. So how did you get there?
I think a lot of it had to do with just like systems and processes. You know, like obviously the first year wasn't like, I would say the probably almost like first 2.5 to 3 years, it wasn't hitting scale at all. It was mainly just like, you know, I think our first year we maybe did like 2, I think our second year we did like 3. But as those systems and processes started becoming something, like our teams grew, our processes grew, we weren't the ones sitting there and putting like in our very first rental, we were the ones sitting there putting like hardware up at night, or like taking the trash out, or getting materials to job sites, or, you know, all the little things that you probably do to get started. But as you convert this more into a business, rather than it's just like a side thing or a hobby or something, and you start putting all those things into place and being like having your response, like having the contractors be responsible for picking up materials, or actually having maintenance crews rather than you going to fix, you know, whatever the small issues are, then you can start making it a business where you can actually grow it and be like, okay, I can plug you here, I can plug you there, I can plug you there. And then where is my time most valuable? And our time is most valuable in finding the deals and putting it together rather than sitting there and doing some of the smaller work that can be offloaded to others.
Love it.
So let's talk through strategy, right? You guys, I've heard a couple of different podcasts you did, but what's your primary investing strategy in the real estate game? Cause there's so many that you can pick from. What did you pick and why'd you pick it?
So we do try to stay pretty close to single families, as our bread and butter. We again venture out to some duplexes, looking at small multifamilies and potentially build to rent portfolios. But the reason why we started with single families and our criteria is pretty precise. We like to buy 50 to 60% ARV because most of the time we don't mind, again, putting in that extra work to be able to get to, you know, kind of have a good equity capture in an initial purchase for us. So like we try to buy at 50 to 60 and we try to be all in. I mean, obviously everyone wants a perfect burr, but it's pretty impossible now in this marketplace. So we usually end up being 80% or 85% on a pretty high deal, in our deal. And then, I mean, we try to buy purchase price it's hard. It's usually the ARV that we look at, because we might buy a home that's $250,000, but as long as the spread's there, it doesn't, and the rents are there, because that's also important, because we don't want to over rotate and be in an area and the rents aren't there either. So I guess single family, 50 to 60% ARV is usually what we like to purchase at. We like brick. We like 1,100 square feet. We can build a bedroom. We can convert a garage, but we don't like getting smaller than 1,100 square feet because, I mean, it gets harder than on the rental side.
So if you're buying properties and you have that 1,100 square foot number in your head, you're essentially looking for 3-2s then, right? 3-bedroom, 2-bathroom. Is that ideal for your scenario?
Whenever we actually tell wholesalers or realtors, we actually don't even tell them how many beds or baths we really need. We just say, get us a square footage for this certain price in this area and we'll make it work.
And we'll make it work.
Because adding bedrooms and bathrooms is literally just reconfiguring things around, which you can build into your budget. But getting the square footage or getting an addition is a little bit more work than just moving a wall here or there.
Cool. Do you have a neighborhood class that you look for? Like, are you guys in the B or C class, or does it not really matter?
Probably. I mean, yeah, it falls into, it's definitely not in A class neighborhoods. Maybe like a few now, because we are starting to look into higher end rentals. Most of our bread and butter area was like where the rents would come in somewhere between the 1,400 to roughly 1,600 range. So that if you work the numbers backwards, how we looked at it was, let's say if we wanted to aim for an average of 1,500 rents, okay, our criteria on the back end side of that rentals was we look for a 3x rental income, or like you have to make 3 times the rent amount, right? So 1,500 rent would fall into a $4,500 a month income, which would translate into about $50,000 a year in income. You're hitting like specifically middle America, which is exactly what we wanted to aim for, is just so that we can get the biggest, biggest pool of renters, because you're hitting the middle income. Just recently, we started venturing out into a little bit higher end on the rentals. We're starting to look at stuff that works for us, like in the $2,500 to $4,000 rentals as well.
Love it. So there's, for people that are watching, you can see this. For people that are not, you can't see the Dallas-Fort Worth map behind you guys. And I wanted to bring this up because, do you live and invest in Dallas-Fort Worth to kind of have this eye on the market? Because there are so many investors that we talk to that invest all the way across the country. They put their teams in different places. They know that this market is going to be theirs. Just talk about Dallas-Fort Worth and your relationship to it.
So I think we both like being semi-hands-on as much as we think we'll be passive one day. I think we like being able to touch and feel what we're purchasing and being at least able to drive neighborhoods and kind of circling out an area where we know we for sure will buy and where we won't. So like a prime example is like yesterday, we both grew up in this area and South Dallas is a transitional part of town. And in my head, I think it's something because I grew up here and South Dallas is something I wouldn't buy. But we decided to just go drive it because we've been seeing a lot of deals come in that area. And we're like, are we just dismissing something that we just, you know, have a perception of? But when you drive it, you're like, wow, this whole area is gentrifying. There's so much change happening and there's a lot of new construction happening. It now opens up our ability to now add that into our criteria search. And I know anyone can do this from everywhere, but you kind of rely on other people to do that granular research for you. And you might have the best rock star team, say if I'm investing in Chicago from here, but I'm also still relying on someone else to make my business succeed versus me, who's going to go drive out at midnight if I need to go search for a deal. There was a deal that came through that, another caveat to this is we also invest almost an hour and 20 minute radius from where we live. So it's not like it's a 5 minute drive by any means. It's you have to kind of plan your day out. Cause traffic also sucks. But one day we saw a deal come in really late at night and me and him both were like, okay, looks pretty good. But it was a Friday and he's tied up all day at Friday in the family business. And I obviously have work to get to. So we woke up at 5 a.m., got in the car, went to go just drive this neighbor because it was again, a new part of town for us. Immediately fell in love with it because it hit all of our criteria. We just were not in the know of the area necessarily, but we were able to get there and lock it up before it got blasted out to the like a wholesaler's entire list. You maybe don't get that dedication from someone else in another marketplace, which is why we decided to hone in on something that we can touch, feel, go experience, actually see, and be a part of the growth that we live in. And then I'm obviously biased. I love the city, born and raised, everything about DFW Marketplace. I love it. So
love that. Anam, I wanted to touch on something that you just mentioned. You said that in the beginning of the show that you work full time.
Yes.
Amir also works full time in the family business. I happen to work in a family business too. So there's a little synergy there, but you are doing all of this in the past 5 years on the side, right? So to me, it's incredible because we've talked about people or talked to individuals who have bought one property a year for 10 years on the side. And by the way, that's great too. But to scale as fast as you have all on the side hustle, I'm curious, like, how do you plan your day? Like, how does this work out? Like, you mentioned driving to a property at midnight. Like, that might work a couple times, but are you doing that every, like, is that a consistent thing? Are you sleeping at all?
Shockingly, yeah. It's pretty consistent. There's a reason we don't have kids yet. It's probably that.
We also live and breathe it. So like, you know, we're sitting here talking about it, like, you know, over dinner, if we're out on a date, you know, whatever the case may be, we're talking about real estate. So if a deal pops up and we're in the middle of a day, we're getting that to go and just go check it out, you know?
And honestly, some of our deals have come that way, and we've probably made like $100,000 or $200,000 in spread on those deals. So it's, if you put in the extra time and extra effort and, I think that's what it is. You have to love it. You have to love, honestly, both sides of it. You have to love what we do at daytime, and you have to love real estate, which is your nighttime, is what I call it. Even though you're working in both all the time. I think if you don't have passion for either, that's where one or the other starts affecting the opposite. And that's when you realize, oh, I can't do this, or I can't do that, or I'm not going to be successful because I'm not giving my 100%. But if you do it, it's possible. We also are not as, like, you know, like a lot of people say they time block or they schedule out their day. We are not that organized enough to be able to be like, we time block our day. Usually in the morning as we're getting up, we both ask, okay, well, what's your day look like today? What's my day look like? Yeah. And then we'll both give each other, okay, make sure you get this, this, and this done today. And he'll be like, make sure you get this, this, and this done. That's our extent of planning.
Yeah. But we do have split roles as to what we do. So that kind of like helps, like, me do what I got to take care of, and she handles her part. And we just kind of know that everything is going to be handled by the end of the day.
Cool. So we just realized that you guys are hustlers and you do this. you don't stop working, but eventually you'll be able to because of all the work that you've put in. My question for you now would be, like, how do you find these deals that are coming up that you're leaving a date to go find? I know that's just, that's not every single day, right? But like, how are you finding these deals? And then also talk a little bit about funding them, because there's, you know, a myth or a not myth, or who knows what it is. Like, you know, once you get to either 5 or 10 mortgages, you have trouble getting further along in that. So are you using portfolio loans? Are you using business lending? Just talk about finding these deals and then how you're going about sourcing the money for them.
We are on, so finding deals, because we have a pretty specific criteria, we basically blast our email to every wholesaler that we can, you know, get our hands on. So we utilize Facebook groups. There's a lot of Facebook groups that are specific to your marketplace that sell off market deals. And so they usually say, looking to add to my buyers list, looking to add to my buyers list. We just throw our email on every single one of those posts. We, you know, obviously are on every mailer list for every big wholesale in the marketplace. So in this one, it's like New Western, Net Worth, Myers. There's, you know, just a handful of really like common ones that send you like lots of deals a day. And so, I mean, I think we joke, but on average, we probably see 100 deals in our email that come through on a daily basis. Some of them might be reblasts that we might have missed, but say you look through 100, because we have a specific enough criteria on where we invest in our purchase price, at least close enough to what we know we will, what we want to be at, we're able to filter through a lot of the clutter. So, but we never ever shy away from getting details on a deal that might hit our criteria, because we want to get the full picture. And so we, again, heavily utilize wholesalers in our market to get our deals. We used to write off MLS because we're like, that's just, everything goes into multiple offer situation. It's just impossible to buy an MLS deal. We've recently, in the last 6 months, gotten 3 deals off the MLS. And what we've learned is those deals, you kind of, even wholesale deals now in DFW, because they go so fast, I think you just have to start building rapport with the people that you're sending offers to versus being a blank email and a blank name. And I know that we might be violating some certain rules out there, but when we send our offers, we do give a boilerplate on who we are and how we're local investors in the DFW marketplace. We're young. We enjoy revitalizing the communities we live in. I'm pretty sure there's some weird rules around you can't usually sell yourself in an offer, especially if it's an MLS offer. But we do it anyways, and it might help them or it might not. Like today I got a deal under contract by just sending her my Instagram link and saying, me and my husband, we are a young couple that loves doing what we do. Sell me the home. Don't sell it to anyone else. Sell it to me. Well, we got the deal under contract.
Yeah.
So really cool. Again, wholesalers, and don't dismiss MLS deals as much as I guess you would want to.
I think it's important to bring up too, you sending your Instagram, because that's like a virtual resume these days. People, when they know you're serious, you're marketable, and like they kind of get to know you, right? Like if you go through couple of your reels, right, where it's like you two talking, it's you really kind of feel like you get to know a person a little bit too, and then you're not just another name in the random like black hole of people that are trying to source deals, right? So I think that's a good addition.
Yeah, and that's exactly why I did it, is because I wanted the person to know I'm not just maybe a newbie, which there's nothing wrong when people are getting started, but I know what I'm doing, my offer makes sense, and I can close because I have the funds. So it was like, how do I get through the clutter? Because she probably is going to get 100 phone calls on this one deal. How do I make how do we sell ourselves, basically?
Right. So I want to touch on to you guys, when you're sourcing deals and you're looking for them, you typically use the area method. And I think this might be something that you coined, just an acronym, right? Everybody likes a nice acronym, right? So can it explain it to us and like how you utilize it in your business?
Yeah. So area, AREA, it's a very quick way for us to very quickly analyze a deal in an area. The A stands for the literal area. Is there investor activity? Is there, are the roads nice? Are their sidewalks? Like, is there development coming? And so like kind of your vicinity, like the area. I feel like I just said that 7 times, but the R is for retail. So, you know, utilize big box retailers like a Walmart or a Starbucks or Chick-fil-A or McDonald's. They're going to do a lot of R&D and they're going to need a lot of foot traffic to meet their daily goals. And so utilize those retailers, research. And that's an area where we do like to buy. And so if there's not a Walmart or a Target or a big grocery store like a Kroger, at least within a 2-mile max radius, I tell them, I'm like, no, we're in the country. I'm not buying it. That is a strategy for some, but it makes it harder to find renters. If you can't easily be accessible to grocery stores, restaurants, schools, which takes me to the next part, the E stands for education. We look to be close to schools. We used to be pretty good on sticking to certain ratings. And I'm not going to lie, I look at the ratings on Zillow. It's the only place I know to get a general idea of what school district and what school the home might fall into. But recently, if the deal still makes sense and we know it might be a younger area in an area or an older area where they may not have kids, we might budge on what level that school's at. Obviously, I won't get down to like the less than 3 range, because that usually means maybe there's crime, like higher crime, maybe the area just isn't developing. Kind of a home run for us is if the school is actually in the neighborhood we buy in, though that's like a no-brainer for us. And then the last A in the area acronym is for ARV. So again, running your numbers, making sure you really do know your numbers. Again, we utilize wholesalers, but I wouldn't take a wholesaler's ARV and bank my business on that. I'm going to do my own research. I'm going to make sure I pull my own comps and kind of make sure I know a comfortable and a conservative amount of what I think the home's going to appraise for before actually being like, yes, it checks all those boxes. Let's get into this home, this area, or this deal. And it's, again, I've said it slowly, but this process can help you analyze a deal in like 2 minutes. You very quickly go to Google Maps. I tell everyone, anytime anyone asks us how you analyze, because again, we buy sight unseen. Most of our homes are sight unseen because we don't have the time to go see them and the market moves so fast. So yeah, when we can't wake up at midnight or 5 a.m. and it comes through in the middle of the day, we for sure are just like, hey, does this work? Do the numbers work? Does the area work? Let's do it. We utilize Google Maps and we'll walk the streets and just look around, like, you know, kind of just, we'll go further down in that neighborhood to get a good feel of, does the neighborhood look like it's clean? Are there bars on windows? Is there a bunch of junk in the front lawns of everyone's home and stuff like that? And that's kind of how we very quickly are able to analyze. And I feel comfortable about any homes that we put a deal or offer on.
I really like that. It's different. I mean, but it's different, but it's more so just taking all the best things, right, and putting them into one consolidated formula or way to do it. So I appreciate that. That's a good one.
Yeah. I know we're going to talk about financing, and I think we'll get to there at some point, but talk to me about the relationship that you've created with these wholesalers and why they trust you now, because they know you're going to close, right? So you're more willing to get properties sent to you if you have 40 units and you're reputable. But how did you create the relationship as you were coming up with these wholesalers? Is it as simple as going onto Google and looking up wholesale companies and calling them and tell them that you're real estate investors and then building the rapport from there? Like, what is the strategy to get the people that are doing the wholesaling every single day, they're making money doing it, to look to you two to say, I know Anam and Amir are going to close?
I think it's a mix of, like, whether you're using social media, any search engines, networking events that happen around the city. Anytime they can put a face with the name, and it also depends on, like, if you're actually, you know, in contact with them constantly. Like, you can't just be a one-off and then, like, you hit them up like 6 months later or 12 months later and then you ask them again. But, like, if this is like your daily business and you're in, like, if you're constantly calling them about deals, like, multiple times a week, then your name is on top of mind. And so they know that you're obviously doing a lot of deals if you're calling them about, oh, can you send me details about this? Or can you give me a contract on this? Then it's just constantly. And then as your list grows and grows and you get in contact with more and more people over the years, you're just contacting more and more guys every single week throughout the years. And your name just kind of sticks around with them.
Okay. That's awesome. That's good advice. I think we want to talk about maybe a specific deal within your portfolio that kind of gives people, paints a picture of maybe either the amount of money that you're making on it through cash flow, purchase price, you know, kind of walk us through some details there if you have, on whether it's your most lucrative or just like maybe a common one that you kind of have a repeatable process with.
Yeah. We'll probably just stick with like one of our bread and butter. This is like a deal that we would do all day, every day. And typically our numbers on those we're picking it up somewhere around the 100,000 range, you know, plus or minus a little bit, whatever. Our typical rehabs are looking like somewhere around the 30 to 35,000 range. We do a little bit extra because we are holding on to these. It's weird because some people say, oh, you're just doing a rental rehab, so it should be a lot less, but that's never the case. It's always a little bit more than a flip rehab. Especially if you're doing it right, because you don't want to get maintenance calls. You might as well just fix everything up front so you're not getting those calls on the back end. So we'll go, like, if a water heater is 5 years old and it's like maybe a 7 year or 10 year lifespan, we'll go ahead and switch that out. If an AC looks like it's 10 years old and it has a 15 year lifespan, we might as well just go ahead and get it switched out right now, so we're not getting those calls on the back end. But typically, yeah, 100,000 is somewhere around the 100,000 range, our purchase. Probably put somewhere around 30 to 35,000 into it. And then ARVs are coming in roughly around 180,000. And that would be a bread and butter deal right there for us.
Got it. And then, so you have that spread, you know, between the 180 and 140 or so that you're creating instant equity with, which is awesome. And then you're renting these properties out for $1,600. Is that kind of in your range?
Exactly. Yep.
Okay.
Got it. Yeah, that's exactly our main numbers.
Okay, so you're at like the 1.2 or 1.3% rule if you're gonna follow that. Meaning,
yeah,
if you're listening, $1,600 in rent. If you're all in for $130,000, you're at that 1.3-ish range. So, that's great.
What goes into your? I'm curious, when you guys go to remodel a house, right? You said you have that typical, like, let's just say $30,000 range. What are you doing to the properties? Do you have a specific, like, I don't want to say cookie cutter, but for you, like a cookie cutter mold where it's like, hey, gray walls, LVP floors, like stainless steel. I know everybody has their own thing. What is your kind of bread and butter there?
So the number one thing is I'll go in on the back end and make sure everything is okay. And then she'll come and just make the place look nice. So like, I'll make sure, like electrical's good. Roof is good. The plumbing's are like updated, you know, like there's like things down to like where basically like a water stop for like a vanity. If you're going to change that out, you might as well get, I mean, if you're going to go in, you might as well get all of those upgraded because those usually go bad. And as soon as those go bad, you have leaky drains and everything's going to mess up. But yeah, things like that, like we'll go ahead and make sure we have enough budget for in the like beginning and make sure how big of a budget that's going to be for that. Like, are we having to redo all the plumbing? Are we going to have to redo all the electrical? And then with what's left is where she kind of comes in and makes the house look as nice as possible.
Love it. Love it. So you're renting it. Ideally, you're in a position to rent it at the top of the market in your area. And then now, which is as hot as the market's ever been, you're probably getting people doing bidding wars with rents. Cause that happened to us. Like, I don't know if that's happening specifically to you. At least people are coming in and you're able to rent it for, we're renting a property a lot higher than we thought we even could. So, but that's because of a well done rehab, right?
Right. Mm-hmm. I actually want to talk about your first deal ever, because I think a lot of people, when they listen to podcasts like this, they're like, okay, it's cool to hear you on number 40, right? And now you guys are just, you almost talk about it so differently now than when you started out, because you just know, you know the ins and outs, right? So can you walk us through your first deal ever? I believe you found it on the Bigger Pockets forum and purchased it sight unseen. So that's like insane in itself. If you could just talk us through that, like how you got to that stage, right? And then how you were confident enough to say, hey, we don't even need to see this place, we're just going to rock out with it. And
being your first too, that's wild.
Yeah. Like, and then going to funding, because like funding these deals, like I know you said you use personal cash, but for like Burr deals, which you guys are kind of, that is your main thing. I'm sure you've used some, whether it's hard money loans, credit cards to pay for the renos, just things to get people an idea of like, hey, like, oh, maybe I don't have to use my own cash for everything.
Yeah. So our very first deal we found on Bigger Pockets, I think what made us really comfortable is, so a year leading up to our first investment, we were just going to every single thing possible to figure out as much as we can about real estate. Whether that was, there was this course that we did, I forgot what the name of it exactly was, but it was like a 2-day course basically that dove very deep into the details of buying a property, rehabbing a property, and then, you know, getting it to the like disposition, whether it's rental or selling it off or whatever the case is. We did one of those courses. We would do a lot of meetups, talk to a lot of people, read books, podcasts were probably our biggest thing. But yeah, we felt very comfortable because after all that as well, we would also drive a lot of different areas all the time. So we would know that like, okay, this pocket of this area is good and we should stay out of this pocket or whatever the case was. And so that's how we kind of felt comfortable getting into our first deal. We also used a lot of like, we used comps. And so our business is based on like straight numbers. It doesn't, like, there's no emotion involved. I mean, if I can get an area that comps at $150 a square foot and I can buy it at $100 a square foot, I know my rehab is going to be $20 a square foot. Okay. My spread's there. I'm good. Like there's no reason not to pull the trigger, right? Especially if it meets the area acronym. So there's no reason to not to pull the trigger. That's exactly how we did our first transaction, because all the numbers hit, the area was good, and we just pulled the transaction on that.
I was just going to ask how you purchased it, like financing wise, and like, did someone have to like run a check somewhere? Like, how do you buy? Didn't you buy it online? Like, I don't. Forum. Like, how did it work?
There was a Visa card logo. We just swiped, put our credit card number in.
If only.
that first deal, it was like, okay. So also leading up back to that original first year of just like getting everything ready. That's when we were trying to get all of our lines of credit ready, and whether that was, so we had a HELOC open on our house, and then we had like at my parents' business that we were working at, we were able to open up a business line of credit, which we had a little bit of access to capital from there. We both opened up credit cards on our names, which was going to fund the materials portion of it. And then, so between our savings and our lines of credit and stuff, that's how we were able to acquire the house. And then using credit cards, that's how we were able to fund the materials. And then we, between our savings, a little bit of savings and a little bit of line of credit, we were also able to pay the contractors to get that first deal done.
Love
it. A little bit of everything.
Yeah, we've talked to this on, I think, our last episode. We're going to close on line of credit in our personal residences in the next few weeks or so. As we started to scale our portfolio, we're like, I'm kind of sick of just saving up this money and then dumping it into this deal and obviously getting a return on it, but it takes you a while so that you can, it's harder to scale that way. So we're taking out HELOCs to take us to the next level too. So I think our last episode was specifically about them. So we'll let you know how it goes, but I think we're advocates of them. So let's talk about financing then after the first deal, as you scale from, 5, 10, 15, are you using the same systems each time? Are you getting into the private money and hard money space? Like, how did you go from maybe 5 to 20? Like that range is potentially the hardest growth.
So I think literally up until the 5, we were doing it the same way. And then we would at the back end, when we would refinance out of it, is when we would get our cash back and then we would revolve that into the next deal. At that point, we were kind of like, we switched our mindset on thinking, because like a lot of the times we would think that the hard money, we would just think about the interest and the fees on it. And so we were just thinking of it in terms of cost rather than in terms of scale. As soon as we switched our mindset to be like, okay, this is not like, you should be using these lenders to help you scale rather than using your own personal cash for all these things. I think that's when we kind of triggered to moving a lot faster. Hard money is a great way to finance a lot of your deals. They do come in quickly, and they do come in at pretty high leverage comparatively. And they'll fund they won't fund your rehabs, but they'll refund you on your rehabs. So like anything that you've done and they can take pictures or come check out, they'll get you money back on that as a portion of what you're doing as your rehab costs. So I think that was a good pivot point for us, is to start using or start working some hard money lenders in to fund our deals.
Would you recommend young or new investors go straight into the outsourcing and using other people's money? Or do you think that it makes sense for young, it doesn't have to be young, just new investors to get their feet wet by using their own capital? I'm curious at the stage that you're at, kind of, if you had to go back, what would your mindset be in the beginning? Would you do it the same way, or how would you recommend other people do it?
I think people need to kind of like see who they are as a person and see how they handle capital. Like, how is their personal debts looking like before they even step into this? Like, are they good with credit cards? Are they good with taking loans on? Are they good with handling other people's money? I think they kind of just need to assess themselves first before they do that. But I think, in the end, I still think if they can come up or figure out ways to fund it without hard money on their very first deal and kind of go through the cycle of trying to be all in on their own rather than use a hard money lender, it might kind of just bake in some, I don't know, just some like guidelines onto like how to do deals and stuff like that before you start taking on other people's money, especially at high risk. I mean, like high rates and high fees and high interest rates. That's very short term. Like hard money loans are not long-term loans. They are due in 6 to 12 months. Sometimes you can push that to 18, but they're very short-term high interest loans. So those are
pretty much only good for BRRRR deals, right? Or maybe potentially like an Airbnb that has a lot of cash flow to pay it back. Is that how you see it? Or
I think flips. Yeah. Or flips. But I think they're just short-term bridge loans, and nobody should ever be looking at this as a long-term solution. They should always have a back-end solution. Are they going to get like, what's their way out of this loan? Like whether they're going to sell the house, are they going to refinance it? How they're going to refinance it? Is it going to be through a local bank? Is it going to be through a portfolio lender? But they should always have the end goal in mind of how they're going to get out of these loans.
Can you just take us really briefly, like at an elementary level, the process of BRRRR and how you pay? A lot of people ask us this, is like, I get when I'm sourcing the money, I have the money now, but like, how am I paying that back? And when, like, what does a refinance even look like? I know it might seem pretty elementary to us, but just so someone can go through the process.
Yeah. So step one, when you pick up the house, is you're contacting your lender. The lender is usually going to get you somewhere between 80 to 90% of the purchase price as a hard money lender. They're going to get you somewhere between 80 to 90% of the purchase price up to 75% of the after repair value. So if we broke it down, if a house is going to be worth, let's just say for easy sake, a house is worth $100,000 after you're done with it, the max loan that they're going to give you with purchase and rehab included is going to be $75,000. Now, let's say if you bought that house for $50,000, that max upfront initial loan that they're going to give you is going to be somewhere in the 85 to 90% range. So 90% on 50,000 is what, 45,000, something like that?
Just about. Ish, yep.
Yeah, something like 45,000 or so initially. So they'll give you the 45,000 initially. Now, whatever your rehab is set, they're going to come and start doing reimbursements. So if they see that you put in 5,000 for drywall, they're going to come and inspect that to see if you did the drywall work and then reimburse you that 5,000 for that. And you could call as many draws as you want. You're paying for the draws for them to come and check out the work. But yeah, they'll reimburse you as soon as you get done with the work. Now, let's say now that you finish your, let's say you have your $75,000, let's say you finish your rehab, you got your full $75,000 on that bridge lending. Now your back end financing, you're trying to figure out one of two things. Well, are you going to flip the house? Then you don't need a back end loan. You're just going to sell the house and it's their loan is going to pay off your loan.
Yep.
If you're going to hold that property, you need to start contacting either a local bank, any of your, any refinance, any person that can do loans. If you're past if you're past 10 units, you need to start talking to commercial banks because there is a 10 unit limit on personal names that you can refinance up to. So then you need to start talking to those people probably before your rehab is done, because there is at least a solid 15, 20 day process of them just processing you as a person before they send appraisers and stuff out to start evaluating the actual property. So after you're done with that, then you're going to do your back-end loan, which is your refinance for your 30-year loan. And that's going to set you up for a 30-year loan. They'll come and pay off your bridge loan. And then you're set with that for 30-year loan.
That was a great breakdown. So thank you very much. I think it's always, you know, to throw out private money and hard money and like to see how it actually works is it's really important for people, because that's the first step to being able to actually go out and execute it. So love it. Do you want to get into partnerships here, Ryan?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay.
So I think it's cool that you both are a husband and wife team as partners, right? Like that's, it's interesting, right? Corey and I,
we're not husband and wife.
Not husband and wife. So there's pros and cons to having a partner in general, right? So I want to talk about that and kind of like how each of you play a role in this partnership. So, and like who excels at what and who is not good at what, I think it's important to see like yin and yang, right? I know you both balance each other out. So can you just talk your experience of working together and like the pros of having a partner in the real estate investing game?
Yeah. So, you know, it is very important to kind of draw a line in the sand of who does what and who does like, I guess this, right? When we start trying to get into each other's lane, that's when we probably start like arguing a little bit more about our business, and it might push us a little bit. You know, the benefit of having a partner is you kind of push each other to be better and be the best version of yourself in your business and even just personally, right? But it can very easily, yes, turn into where you both are just going at it all the time because you're like, I'm doing my fair share, why are you not doing your fair share? And, you know, so that's the downside of it. And then again, another part is when you're also married too. Okay. So there's no, you go to each other's homes afterwards. I mean, you live in one place together.
Yep.
So you really do have to work at making that partnership work really well, because you don't want it. I mean, at the end of the day, no amount of money is worth your relationship, in my opinion. And so you do have to kind of really draw out and hope that your partner is really doing what they're supposed to be doing. You can probably even tell from this podcast, I don't like numbers. You will almost never see me speak. Anytime a question came up about finances, it is him that speaks about it. That is what he excels at. He loves Excel sheets and chart. I don't even know stuff that I don't like. I like the designing stuff, finding the deals, marketing ourselves, you know, kind of building a brand. I like the people side of it. So I do a lot of our leasing and listings. And I mean, we're DIY landlords also. So like we do a lot of that. I like the people side of our business and the design and where you get to be creative. And he likes the numbers. And if it was up to him, he'd probably sit behind a computer the entire day. But he does manage our contractors because he's good at project management, which I'm too, but again, I'm tied up on a more cookie cutter 9-to-5 during the day. So I, that's just not my task, I guess. But I do get all the all the floor plans, all the scope of work, and I do all of that. So then he can succeed in his side of the business, basically.
I think it's really important to bring that up, and it makes a lot of sense listening to that. You actually balance each other out extremely well, which makes not only the marriage work, but the business work too. And to have both of those going at the same time is, it's a feat, right? Ryan and I are actually very similar in our business. So whatever we don't do, we just outsource to other people that can do it. But we've been told by numerous people, don't get into business with somebody that you're really close with, a friend or a partner. Especially if you're both good at some of the same things. Now we have some differences, but a lot of the things we're good at together. So we found the best way to balance that out is to outsource other tasks to people who are, you know, leverage our network to people who are better than we are at certain things. So I think it's great that you two are able to, I said it before, just balance each other out. It's working.
Yeah, it's definitely working. I think it's cool to have a partner in this as well. It's just to get you excited about it and right, have things to look forward to and motivate each other, hold each other accountable. It's a lot harder to go alone, I think. You can have your own, you can argue, right? You can have your own ideas and everything's going to be your way if you go by yourself, but just kind of sharing, I don't know if you've ever, I guess I'll correlate it to like going on a trip or something, right? And have you ever been on a trip or something, or you saw something amazing, you saw it by yourself and you're like, that was cool. But when you see it with someone else, it's just sharing that is just so much better. So for me, I really like that part of our business. It's just, you know, he might like something way more than I do, but just watching him get excited about it gets me excited about it. So it just helps you get through it. And there's not always, it's not always sunshines and rainbows right? Like there's some tough days. There's a lot of paperwork, which I know you may like, but I know you don't. So it's just one of those things that where you're constantly like pulling each other up on certain days. So I like partnerships and I recommend it for people that are getting started. And it just, you have to be careful with who you become a partner with, right? Because you share a lot of things. Like we've seen bank accounts, we know each other's net worth. Like there's just a lot of stuff that we know. And if you don't trust that person for the long term, it's can get scary.
Take that back. It kind of is like we're married in a way. So yeah.
Pretty much.
The papers say we are. So
yes.
Pretty much, dude.
Yeah. So thank you for sharing about your specific partnership. Before we get into the last couple segments of the show, I want to talk about self-managing and the systems that you've created and why you've decided to work 9-to-5s go into all these acquisitions and then also manage it, because there's property management companies out there that have 40 units. So you have essentially probably more than three businesses, but I just named three there. So why did you decide to self-manage, and what are some of the systems that you have set up to make that run as efficiently as possible?
I think our whole goal, like of our whole business structure, is to vertically integrate everything. If we can in-house construction, property management, acquisitions, lease-ups, I mean, all of it, we can kind of grow it and get the feedback from everybody else on what we're doing good, what we're not doing good, so that we can make our business better in terms of all of it, right? Because if we get tenants that specifically keep saying something about our properties, okay, well, now our construction team can start doing that and integrating that into the next set of properties, so that we're not, you know, like it's kind of like bouncing feedback off of the tenants and the contractors and, you know, just kind of everybody to try to make your business as good as possible all around. And then if you do know everything to, like, you know, if you've been building that, you kind of know the ins and outs of each of those segments of those businesses. You could bring internal staff to start handling those things once you need the help. So it's kind of like you're just keeping everything in house and building your business bigger.
You're almost building your own property management company at that point. It's interesting. Some people it. Some people are absolutely want nothing to do with it. So I guess if I ask you this question, like, do you believe it's worth the 8-10% that you'd have to fork up to just run it yourself, right? Or do you like the fact that you can customize it to your own and have it your business exactly, not have to like worry about the reputation of the property management company? Like, I guess that's why you decided to keep it under your own hood.
Yeah. So it goes back to why we buy in the market we live in. I don't think anyone can do, it's a hard thing when you talk, we're also in the scale mode because we do need other people on our team at some point, but no one, I feel like, will care about your property. We'll just be one of their 20 clients. Right. So it's our money that we've invested in that home. It's like, it's basically our, it's us on it's our assets on the line. You know what I mean? So they don't care. They're going to get their paycheck. They're going to, you know, and so I think that's what we struggled with. And when you times it all up and you look at, wow, I would be writing that amount of check to someone else to watch over my properties when we can very well do it still ourselves. We do, like, I mean, we pay for software like Buildium, for example. That's where our property management is run through. That's where our leasing comes in. That's where we list our homes. That's where maintenance tickets. And, you know, we're able to house all of that. If something like that didn't exist, again, our conversation might be different right now. We'd be like, yeah, for sure, someone should handle this. We do not have the time to go find checks in people's mailbox. Like, that's just, you know, the whole lost check in the mailbox story. We wouldn't do any of that. So I mean, the short answer is I'm not willing to give up any money. And then it's doable. So why would we have someone else do it?
Yeah. I like that. I think it's very cool. So I use Buildium to help you, I guess, essentially be your own property manager. Right. But also and the reason I'm bringing this up is because we also use this for like content creation and things, but I know you guys use Asana too. Do you still use that for daily tasks? And does that just kind of help you guys keep each other in check to make sure you're like up to date on whether it's, I don't know, maintenance or tasks?
So we, again, I'm telling you, you would think we'd be organized for us to be doing what we do. We always start using Asana and I think we do it for 2 weeks and then you go back and you're like, wow, I created this task a year ago.
geez, that's great.
So, I mean, we have the thought process of maybe one day it's all set up. Our framework's set up in there. If like everything's set up, I mean, it's just, we move a million miles a second that we don't have the time. We don't have the time to sit down and like really actually probably utilize it. Log in. So like we both utilize like notes on our phones, and he has an Android and I have an Apple. So it's not even like we have shared notes, which is the worst thing in the world.
Wow. I can't believe we're talking to you guys. Android, what's going on?
This Seriously. Is how you know we are completely opposites. Like,
I was about to say, if you guys,
she likes everything I don't, and I like everything she doesn't. Like, we're completely.
If you can do it, anyone can do it. That's what I'm saying, and I mean that in the most respective way possible. But like, it's funny that you say that. But also, let's point out the fact that you live under the same roof, right? So it's not like for us three, like you have Corey, Jake, and myself, and we need to be able to hold each other accountable, right? So to have one software that we can log into each and then just see what each other are doing, because we all have different roles as well.
Yeah,
that helps us. I'm not checking in with Corey at, like, after dinner or during dinner, right? So no worries on Asana. I was just curious because we love the software, so I just wanted to vouch for it too.
Yeah, I mean, I use it at my work. Like, it's what I make my team use, so I know what they're doing.
That's great.
We use notes, we use calendar,
invites, we do count. Well, and it feels like like we're so lame to be doing this, but we have to send each other the calendar invites, even just our personal things, like, hey, we have to be at this birthday party at this time or else we won't remember.
I'm the same way with my wife. I like that, actually. Just it keeps me organized, one spot, and then I'd not yell that if I forget about it, right? It's already in there. Like, it is on me if I forget, because if it was on my calendar, right? So I like that. It's just cool to give people an idea of like how you hold each other accountable. Shared notes is a good thing. I don't know if that's like a new thing for on Apple and Android, but like you're able to share your notes and it's live, like a Google Doc. So if I update something, Corey can see it and it'll say Ryan updated this at this time, which is super cool. So everything, technology is helping the small time landlord in more ways than ever before. So it is very possible. Like you said, you have a 40 unit portfolio. That's pretty damn big. And you're able to manage it on your own and you're not losing that 8-10%. So all the power to you. I think it's great.
Yeah. So, and then running the numbers basically on your portfolio, just doing some estimation on our end, I'm looking at this like, okay, you guys are probably bringing in somewhere between $10,000 and $20,000 a month in cash flow. Maybe that's up, down. I don't know exactly, but the reason why I bring this up is like, what is your end goal with it? You are running around. You're running around like crazy. You're in the acquisitions phase. You're doing all this. A lot of people get into real estate investing so they can take their foot off the gas a little bit. Is there a point in time that you want to do that? Is there a number of units you want to get to? Is there an amount of cash flow that you want to get to? Or is it just, you're just trying to build this as big as possible and you'll know when you get there, or maybe not?
I think one thing in real estate is you will see the brokest people that look good on paper. Because literally none of the money that you make is actually coming to you, because it just gets reinvested into the next deal. So no matter how much is actually coming in, you always feel broke. Like there's literally like never any money in the bank or anything like that.
But yeah, well, you hope that one day that there is, right? So would your goal be to sell your portfolio as together, or what is the, where's the
end goal fall into?
Yeah, what does that goal look like?
I don't know. So one of the maps that you can, or one of the charts we have on our wall that you can't see is I think before we turn 40, before we turn 40, we want to have $100 million in assets under management. That is our goal. That's when we know, okay, fine, let's take the foot off the gas. That's when we know we did enough to get to where we feel quote, quote, comfortable. I mean, you can argue that we'll probably live a comfortable lifestyle now, but to his point, we invest every dollar, like literally every dollar. Like, I don't think I even see any of the money we make in any of our rentals, like at all. That just goes, it stays in the maintenance side, or it goes into reinvesting to buy more deals and, you know, kind of do more there. I think where we might consider, I think once you get to 100 units, I think that's an easy option for us to consider potentially walking away from, like, you know, doing 3 or 4 businesses to, you know, maybe doing just real estate and vertically integrating that business and really growing that and scaling that to what he said, potentially having, you know, the retail side of real estate or the insurance side or the lending, I mean, all bringing it all in house and then, you know, kind of going upwards and our integration in that.
Yeah.
And there would be like a myth that, you know, once you have the ability to run 3 or 4 businesses like you're not going to stop. And when you get to a certain point and say, okay, I'm just going to kick my feet up and, you know, move to a foreign country and not worry about anything because you have built this thing and your brain is wired to do that. So that doesn't mean you couldn't take your foot off the gas, like you said, and more enjoy the fruits of your labor. But I think the point is that if you have the ability to build it like this, you're not just going to cut it off completely and retire, so to speak, in air quotes, at 40. At least it doesn't sound like that from interviewing the two of you.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think the vast majority of people we talked to initially started it just to get out of their W-2s, or what they thought would be getting out of their W-2s, right? Like, stack up enough cash flow, right? And then whatever, as long as I'm paying my expenses, and then there's even a bigger gap, a little bit of a cushion, right? Like, I'm living my lifestyle. But you guys seem to have taken like this super passion for it now, and you're just like, it's consumed your thoughts, it's where your passion lies, right? So I actually like that answer. I think it's different that you're just like, I don't know, like 100 million, that's a lot. It's not a lot. To live comfortably, you're gonna live way more than comfortably with that. You know, that paves the way for future generations, and it's tackling a lot of things. But then even within it, you're saying, hey, we'll just pick a lane and stick with it from there. We might not continue to scale the portfolio, but we love it so much that this is, we know where we're supposed to be, and we're just going to peel off a layer and go that way at one point. So really cool.
Yeah. Cause I mean, exactly what you just said right there, what we always tell people, this isn't a hobby, or to your point, it's not a retirement for us. Like this is a bit, we are building a business and we want to build that generational wealth. We want our, you know, you just want it to be passed along in the family. And that completely changes your mindset, because we could have sat there and been like, 20 units, that's good. It pays the bills and let's call it a day. And there's nothing wrong with that. But I think because we enjoy it, it doesn't feel like work, even though some days are hard. It's a business. Like, you get, it's addicting. You get so addicted to it. I think that's what it is. It's like a real life game of Monopoly. You get
especially
so addicted
when you get good at it. That's the thing. And you're like, why would I just think about this? And you sometimes think about this with athletes, right? They just become so good at it, and it becomes a habit, and they're at the top of the game, and then they're like, I'm not gonna retire, but their body gives up on them, right? Like, you guys, if you have the systems in place, like, it's not gonna give up on you, right? You can just keep chugging this along, and if it's pumping cash in, why you wouldn't give it up, right? You just pass it down to your kin, right? And then it goes down for them too. So one thing is, we don't see, I mean, most millionaires don't see real estate going anywhere, right? So I think you found the right lane, and if you can keep passing that thing down, you're in a good spot. So
I couldn't agree more. I think that's very well said. And it, once you have this personal finance and investing mindset, I agree with you that it becomes addicting. We said this on multiple episodes, where like, if we have too much money sitting in our bank account, essentially losing money every month because of inflation, we're like, we got to get this out of our bank account. So that mindset to keep reinvesting in your business will propel you to that 100 million. You'll get there before 40. I don't see why not. So we made it to the second last segment of our show. get to know you a little bit more personally, although I think we're starting to do that already. The first question of the core four is, what's your favorite investing or business book, maybe that helped you scale or get started, or whether it's a mindset shift for you? What's your favorite book?
Mine is, it's called Start With Why. I think that's what it's called. I think that not knowing your why, again, what your end goal is, or what you want out of life, or what, you know, kind of what your real why is, like what makes you wake up. I think not knowing that won't help you succeed in anything you do, but knowing it helps really paint a clear picture on how to get to that point in your life on where you really are happy and you feel like you're fulfilling yourself.
Love it. Cool.
I don't think I've ever made it through a book, so I can't say I have a favorite book. I'm more of a podcast guy, or more of a like YouTube person. Like if there's like certain things I'm looking for, or certain things I'm like really just trying to learn about, I'll watch short videos or something on that, or especially documentaries. I love watching documentaries, or not documentaries, like interviews on people. So like, you know, I'll watch interviews on random people that have made it, and just kind of see like where they came from or how they got started and how they got to where they are.
That's a really cool, I'm not afraid to say it now. You may be not afraid to say it. I can't finish a book either. I literally can't do it. I mean, Audible is great. So anytime I tell any, I'm lying to everybody listening to this podcast. Anytime I say I read a book, it's always Audible. So I've never,
it's always me who read the damn book. And I'm like taking notes and highlighting shit. I bought him a couple books. He's like, thanks, dude. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot you don't read. So I just went to it. So, but he'll listen to it. And he's actually very in tune with podcasts every day. You're like pretty rigorous with that. Yeah. Like every time you're in the car with bigger pockets, or
I'll listen to podcasts or YouTube is the best
for me. You could throw it on at the gym. You could throw it on when you're driving, and like that's a good amount of your day. Like you can consume at least like 2-3 hours of the day like that.
Totally. I said that I turned my after college. Well, maybe like 3 or 4 years after college, I turned my vehicle into like a moving education system, right? Like I just like, this is meaning my car. Like that was just what like to and from wherever you are. If you can consistently be learning while you're doing that, if you have to be in the car anyway, then you're not really spending any more time, you know, sitting at a desk. You're doing it while you're getting other things done, being productive, getting somewhere.
So. Like listening to your favorite song is over and over. Yeah. You know the lyrics, it's not getting you any better at anything.
No, it's
you know
not.
What I mean? Unless you're enjoyable. Nice at karaoke, but whatever.
Yeah, no, I'm not.
No. I mean, not bad.
okay.
That's funny. But it was on, I had something about the books. It's always about the books with me. I just wanted to talk about how you said you're really into YouTube, right? And the small video clips. It's funny. We started getting so much into listening to podcasts. We were like, wait, exactly. What we said, instead of listening to documentaries or watching documentaries of people that are successful, we're like, hey, like let's just interview them and see if we can get them on our show. And then we do that. And then we'll find a subject or something like within an interview that we like. So for example, we interviewed someone on HELOCs. We're like, great. These sound amazing. So then we went YouTube, million different YouTube videos on HELOCs, ins and outs of them, called the banks, got our HELOCs. So it's just one of those things. It's just like, you kind of go down the steps, and there's so much free stuff out there on the internet. YouTube is amazing. Like seriously, it's the biggest cheat code of all time. You can, you know, you got to figure out like if someone's actually as knowledgeable as you say. Sometimes you get through your video and you're like, dude, we didn't even, talk about what you said you were going to. Other times you get a lot of really good information, and I'm a note taker. So that's kind of good for me. It's almost like a spark note version of a book. So
to reiterate here, Start With Why by Simon Sinek. I think that's how you pronounce it. Now I know who this guy is. There's so many videos of him. He's like, he does the TED Talks. He's a genius. Like, like you listen to him, you're like, I am so dumb, but that's at least how I listen to it. Anyway.
I've listened to plenty of videos.
Him and Jordan Peterson. I'm like, why am I even alive? These guys are too much smarter than
me. To learn from them, dude. Pass it on. There you go. That's good.
Second question.
Second question on the core four is, if we gave you an additional lump sum of $50,000 today, what would you do with it? How would you invest it? How would you spend it, and why?
That's a tough one.
I would leverage it.
Yeah.
Like literally any cash that you have, it should be leveraged. You should never be using cash. So if you can go and pick up a house with a small down payment and leverage that up to $10,000 down on five houses, leverage it up, use bank debt, use other people's money, and just try to make the most as you can out of it. Because in the long run, like you said, inflation is a thing. I'm glad that you mentioned that, because a lot of people don't actually pay attention to that. Inflation is a real thing. Like, you should not be holding on to cash. It is a hidden tax that nobody even assesses ever.
Yeah. And it's not only, it's a talking point now because of the stimulus and how much money has been spent in our economy, that it's up to 6.5% or 7%. But inflation is consistently 3%, no matter what's going on in the economy. So if you have a significant amount of money sitting in cash, you're legitimately losing it. And people think that you're playing it safe, but you're actually, it's the at the most risk when it's sitting in a bank account. So we try to reiterate that for people. It's a hard mindset to get into because you think it's safe, but it's not about the money coming out of your account. It's about your buying power. And that is the hardest thing for people to switch on in their head.
It gets me so bummed when you're whether it's a family party or something, and you hear a dad or an older person giving advice to someone just out of college. You're like, oh, did you open up your money market savings account? I'm like, dude, that is literally the worst thing you could do. And I'm sitting there, I'm just like, I'm not saying it. I'm not going there. And I'll talk to this dude for an hour. And it's just funny. I've heard in the last couple of months, I've heard this, and I just I got to walk away because it'll just bring me down this rabbit hole. I'm like, go listen to, you have not listened to one episode of our podcast, clearly. Yeah. It's funny though, because that is what they're accustomed to. And that's what everyone told them to do. Right. And they think that's the right thing. And it's just, it does take a little bit more research, but it's kind of out there now, especially I think Corey said, people are talking about inflation because of the stimulus and everything that went on with COVID and just where the economy is in general. People are actually taking an interest in their personal finances, I feel a little bit more than they ever did.
And now Gen Z is millennials are screwed, right? So Gen Z it's going to be worse for them. We're millennials, so we get it. I think, I don't know if you can't get by without investing. I think at a certain point it's going to be like that. So
it's a long topic. Yeah.
Yeah. So good luck, everybody. Question three. Yeah. What's been your biggest mistake in your investing journey and how have you learned from it?
I mean, okay. So it's probably not a biggest mistake because you learn so much from this one mistake, but kind of getting in the rhythm of things and trusting people more than you probably should. Again, going back, it's your business. Yeah. Contractors. Okay. it's that rookie, quote unquote, rookie mistake. We've never ever paid a contractor up front, fully, but that's again, a rookie mistake. So hopefully none of you guys listening never do that. But what we did is we probably had the same contractor and crew that did up to 10 homes of ours maybe. And you get in this rhythm and you trust them, but they kind of start becoming, they're kids and you feel like you're starting to become have a business relationship. And the next thing you know, they could be gone overnight and you have no idea. And because you kind of got comfortable in this situation, you might've been giving a little bit more money than the amount of work that's done in the home. And you screw yourself at the end of the day because everyone's just going to look out for themselves. But I think that's the biggest mistake I would say we probably made, is don't get too comfortable and think everyone has your best interest, because there's great people out there, but not everyone's going to have their best interest.
I have a very, this is just a recent one for us, but it's actually a funny example. You said it doesn't have to do specifically with a contractor. It's with one of our tenants, right? And for whatever reason, I'm correlating it to this. So if I'm off, just let me know. But basically, one of our tenants is a Section 8 tenant, and she's been honestly nothing but a breath of fresh air since we've had her under our roof, right? And so we ended up buying this property. She was already in there. She'd been there for 10 years, and we knew her. She was paying under market value. She's at, I think it's $950, and we could probably get $1,200 or something like that. So that's there's a little gap there, right? You have to get it. You have to go to the office to get it raised every year. You can only raise it 3%. So there's a lot, and you guys do Section 8, so you're probably familiar with this, but we sent her a holiday card. She was always super polite, and any of the text exchange we had, right? And so one day we get a text from her saying, hey, my oven's broken. I need someone to come take a look at it. All right. So we sent our contractor out. Contractor gets there and he's like, hey guys, this door, it was bent to the other way, like the socket or the, I don't know. There's like a metal piece on the door handle. She's like, she clearly fell on this and broke it, the door off basically. Oh. And he's like, and you know, he took some pictures, he sent us to him. We're like, oh, okay. So the next day we sent this really nice text and we're just like, hey, you know, so-and-so went there to check out the property. We, you know, we noticed XYZ happened based on the pictures. He mentioned that it looks like a bunch of weight fell on it, whatever. She ended up telling him that she fell in the kitchen. We already knew it happened. She got furious and sent us a text back basically saying, I'm going to, if this is not fixed within 30 days, we said, hey, we feel appropriate. We'll pay for half if you meet us halfway, right? And we'll just get you a new one, right? Because they're not going to fix the door. The metal was bent. It was 10 years old. We're like, hey, listen, let's just get it done, get a new one. That's kind of how we do our thing. She came back exact opposite and crazy, something we had never expected, and was just like, hey, I'm going to report you to the Section 8 office unless this is fixed within 30 days. And how could you ever take advantage of a senior citizen? We're like, dude, are you kidding me? That's like the furthest thing from what we do ever. And we looked at each other. We're like, nah, we're done. We're getting property managers. Like, we're done. Because we're losing it. We're like, we don't want to renew her, blah, blah, blah. And like, the poor lady just like probably does not have the cash to fix it. And she's like, the only way that I'm going to be able to fix this is just to stick with my story and ride it out. And they're going to have to pay. We didn't clearly fight it. We didn't want to be, it's for $500. We're like, dude, we'll keep you in there. Yeah. Keep you happy. I was a little pissed, I'll be honest. I was just like, can't believe you would think we would ever try to do like pulling on you. That's not how we run our business. We'll have a new oven in there in 2 days. It literally on Monday it was fixed. So long story short, everything's good to a certain point, and then someone can flip a switch and you're like, holy shit. Like, it kind of blew my mind, right? You had someone that did 10 properties for you based on what I'm like inferring here. And then maybe they dipped and you never saw them again. So it's just like, it's interesting the way people work when you really find out who someone is when shit hits the fan or like something goes wrong. And so for us, this was just a pivot point that built up onto a number of different issues with other people. And we're like, hey, it's time for us to move our business into full-time property management. I know that you guys don't do this, but for us, it's just, we both have not very busy 9-to-5s and where we can't deal with the like plugging people together. Hey, maintenance, go here, go here. We rather source deals and work on the podcast and other things. So today we just interviewed, over the last couple of days, we interviewed like 3 different property management companies. And I think that was like the one thing that pushed us over the edge. We were like, damn, like we don't know. We didn't want to have to battle her with Section 8 court or however you want to go there. And we tell the property manager the story. And he's like, oh dude, we got you. Like we deal this with every day. Like, good. Here you go. Like you can take it. Yeah. So
yeah.
It was just one thing that recently came up to us and it kind of blew our minds. We're like, damn, like we never would have thought that. She's the last person we would have guessed that would give a shit. And
yeah, she gave a shit.
She gave a shit. So she's getting someone else to talk to. See you later.
So
last question, the core 4, it kind of goes to your book recommendation. You'll understand what I mean. The question is, what do you want your legacy to be? So I know we asked you this, like, why do you guys do what you do? What's your end goal? But more so is just like, what is your why? Like, why do you guys get up out of bed every morning and say, hey, like real estate's my thing. I'm going to build this thing. Start with why. What's your why?
It's like the cachet one, to build a better life. I mean, you know, kind of to have that, our why is to one day not be tied to a desk or a chair and be able to, you know, kind of take ownership of our own outcome in life. I mean, I feel like it's the very cachet answer, but for me, that's what it is. I want to be able to say, if we did want to close our computers and walk away for 2 weeks, we could do it and know everything's going to be just fine and financially things are going to be fine and things are running. I think both of us had interesting childhoods that, you know, kind of had where things were tough in at home. And I think we never, ever want to see a day like that ever. And I think that's one part of what probably gets us to be better. Cause it's not even just for us, it's for our families. We also want to make sure they never see a day like that ever again either.
I like that.
Great answer. So we've made it to the last drop. And the last drop is, knowing what you know now, what advice would you give your younger self? It sounds like you may have a lot to say on that. And just in terms of, you know, just mentioning where you came from, what do you think you would tell if you had to go back to, I don't know, 15, 16 year old yourselves, what would you say?
Probably just like, I know that this is probably like most kids wouldn't do this anyways, but like it would just be to start earlier on focusing on like a larger career path. A lot of people don't even know what they want to do until, you know, maybe they're even in their 20s, 30s, sometimes 40s. They don't even know what they want to do. But I think it would be to pick one thing and kind of stick with it. I think the more that you can do with like a certain thing, like, you know, a lot of people get scattered and like they do a little bit here, a little bit there, and then they might spend like 5 years on this project or, you know, 5 years on a different thing and just keep hopping around. I think it would be to stick with something that you actually love to do and try to make it as big as you can. Because if you love it, you're not going to dread going to it every single day. You know, like a lot of people dread going to their 9-to-5. It's most likely because they went into a field that they don't like or that thought they like, or it's something that their parents try to force them into. But if they actually pick something that they love to do and stuck with it over a good amount of time, like it's going to pay out dividends, like compounded dividends over time, because you've just been like, by the time you've done it, like if you've been doing the same thing since like, I don't know, like look at LeBron. Like if he's been playing basketball since he was a kid, at 18, he's already got into the NBA. And just because he's been in the NBA from 18, he's like at the end of his career at like 30s or mid 30s or so. And you know, like that's young, like it's still super young, but like he's dedicated himself for the first 35 years of his life to do one single task. And he's gotten so good that he's at the top of his game already.
Yep. I love that. And I'm a big LeBron guy, a basketball guy in general. So I can relate to that, but LeBron is like the example of the epitome of the best too. But you can even use anyone who plays in the NBA as an example of somebody who has dedicated time and energy, maybe with a little bit of luck, but has consistently dedicated that time and energy to something. And it applies to, in my estimation, anything in life. And, you know, we talked about this on a previous podcast that I don't know if it's a meme or a gif or whatever of like the guy with the pickaxe that's like really close to the diamonds. He can't see on the other side of the rock, you know, and it's not to say that every time you quit, you're right there. But I think if you do quit, you're guaranteed not to get there. So that is kind of the overarching message. And I love that.
Yeah. It's interesting. Someone said to me the other day, and I knew it was someone that wasn't following the podcast or following our journey, right? Until it got cool. And they were like, oh yeah. Like I just knew in the beginning that this person wasn't like super supportive. Yeah. Sort of. They just kept it quiet. The other day came up to me like, dude, you got your podcast. Awesome. I was like, oh, thanks, man. He's like, yeah, 18,000 followers. I'm like, yeah. And I was like, so how many episodes you listen to? He's like, oh, I mean, I haven't dove in yet, but like clearly people like it. I'm like, oh, cool, dude. Like you just looked at the follower count. It was just it's just one of those things, like the clout thing. It just kind of blows my mind. And now that it's cool, right? And he's like, oh, yeah, we listen to it. I looked back and we posted our 700th post. That's every single day for 700 days. We got better each and every day, right? And you continue to learn from it. This is not overnight. This is like the one thing that, you know, that I can let people see tomorrow, right? They're not going to understand everything in our real estate portfolio and say, oh, here's success. That's taken 2 to 3 years, but here's something every day for 2 straight years that we posted and we changed up. And then they just see the 18,000. They're like, oh yeah, I assume it's pretty cool. People like it. I'm like, dude, you don't know what goes on behind the scenes. And like for LeBron to be as good as he is, right? And all these kids to make it the NBA, there's so many hours in days and time that goes by that they're perfecting their craft. Like think about you guys and like you're learning so many different lanes that we talked about, right? How many things go into Burr, right? That's not one thing. You're like estimating rehab costs, marketing, just a million different things. So I just think about how important it is to like sharpen the axe every day. And it is really cool to see your own success, but it's weird that people just assume they can't do something or they can do something based on what they see. They're like, oh no, I'd never get to LeBron's stature because I'm not willing to put in that time. Right. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. And we'll wind down the show here too. We were getting a little excited, the both of us, as you can tell, but the basketball analogy, I just have one more example there for somebody like Steph Curry in the All-Star game. I think he hit like 15 threes or something the other night. And, Reggie Miller was the announcer and he said, you know, Steph Curry's ruined the game of basketball because he walks onto a basketball court wherever, where he watches little kids and they take one step over half court and they're shooting. That's what they start with. And they're shooting threes. Like that, like that is how Steph Curry, somehow he just stepped on a court and became that way. Meanwhile, Steph Curry has probably shot thousands and thousands of shots a day to be able to do it essentially without looking. So it's like the time, the effort, the hours that goes into it, it's all behind the scenes stuff. And that's a testament to you guys and what you've built, and what people see on the surface is clearly they don't see the 120 hour weeks. And I know that you're working them. So
yeah, we could never, the whole point of me bringing it up is like, we could never fully explain to someone how much time, effort, blood, sweat, and tears it took you guys to get to 40 units, right? We just share an hour's worth of your story, talk about systems, how you got there. But there's those days that are just inexplicable. And you're just like, we got up, we dealt with 5 million things that went wrong, but one thing went right and it helped us get to the next level. And it's just a testament to what we're all doing as real estate investors, right? And like, I think that's why it's fun for us all to talk to each other, because we know for a fact we're all tired. We're all doing a late interview tonight, right? And but we love talking about it and we want to help other people out, and we've seen success, but it takes a lot of time, effort, and hard work and studying and doing the things that you're basically going to school again, but your own, like, I don't know, school of hard knocks, we're teaching ourselves. So it's a long one. That was a good analogy, the basketball thing. So
yeah,
good to bring up.
Cool. So first of all, I want to thank you for coming on. I thought it was awesome. As you can tell, Ryan and I get a little excited about this, a little passionate. But if people enjoyed your story, they want to learn more about you, maybe network, partner, who knows what, how can they reach out to you?
The easiest place to find us, we try to be super active, but life kind of gets the best of us, but Instagram is probably the best place to find us. DM us, we might take a second to respond, but we do try to respond back to all of our DMs. Our handles at Rehab Rental. But again, it's usually me that you're going to be talking to and interacting with, but I act like it's the two of us. But
I'll chime in here and there.
Yeah. He'll help me get the context, but, that's the easiest place. We do really like sharing what we do. Again, to, kind of what we just said, it does. Social media scratches the surface on what all of us probably do in order to succeed in this business, but it's still a great way to make it relatable to someone who's wanting to get started. And we really do try to make it relatable. We're not going to be over here trying to sell you this like get rich quick scheme of like, invest with us because you're gonna make a bajillion dollars. Well, we want to help you invest your own money into your own portfolio. We don't even want to sell you anything. So really, if you want an authentic look into two folks doing real estate, follow us.
We will. We'll absolutely tag you in the show notes, and then we'll have some clips and things coming out too. But thanks for an awesome episode. It was a pleasure getting to know you guys. We had a blast and learned a lot. So thanks.
Yeah, that was great. Appreciate you guys.
Thanks for tuning in this week. If you enjoyed the show and like what you heard, please subscribe, share it with friends, and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. The more ratings we get, the more eyes we'll get on our show, and in turn, we'll be able to provide you all with high-quality guests. It's simple. Open your podcast app, type in our podcast name, The Weekly Juice, click on reviews, and let us know what you think. Thanks so much, and see you next week.